So I should start with a disclaimer. As a political physicist, not an evolutionary biologist, one might question the wisdom of the management of asking a theoretical physicist to talk about biology. But fortunately, there are some evolutionary biologists here for a program, and some of them may be in the audience, and they hopefully will correct me on facts, on some facts if I get them wrong. But I reserve the right to disagree with what a fact is, which is relevant in this. So I, like many scientists and many others, always found evolution a fascinating subject, and would read a bit about it and hear things, but always was left with some puzzlement, and particularly finding it was very hard to see any numbers ever mentioned in any books or things, and being a quantitative person, that was something that was a bit bothersome. And I expected that if I started to learn more about evolution, that I would get less puzzled, and the puzzles would sort of be resolved. And so about 10 years ago or so, when I sort of felt I was too professional at the things I was doing in physics and was looking to become an amateur again, and so I started talking to people and learning a bit more about evolution, and I found that the exact opposite happened, that I got more and more puzzled instead of less and less puzzled. So I know a bit more about evolution than I did then, but I think the main things I know more about are maybe what the questions are and how to frame some of the questions. So this talk, as its title illustrates, is going to be mainly about questions. I will say a little bit about some very minor things that I've done and perhaps some ways towards some of those answers. But it really is focusing on the questions, a lot of which I really don't even know how to frame properly at this point. So the basic laws of evolution have been known for 150 years. There's overwhelming evidence for them. But not all of it is understood, and particularly the aspects which aren't understood that I'm going to focus on are the dynamics of actually the evolution action and things really changing, and almost any quantitative issue. So a title for this talk could have been that evolution is a fact, but far from a fully fledged theory, at least to a physicist. But a physicist doesn't begin with an F, so I didn't alliteration. So the basic laws of evolution, to go back to Darwin, the most famous one, so survival of the fittest and selection or inherited variation, and that's the crucial bit, it has to be inherited. And around the same time, Mendel, but much less acclaimed, what he called the factors of heredity, which we now know as genes. And an important thing about those, they were a discrete set of characteristics. And the famous ones is the peas being either yellow or green, but they weren't some mixture between them, and those were somehow inherited in a way that it was either one or the other. An important role that wasn't understood for some time later. But the question of what is the variation that is selected on, of course, what needs the variation, and the origins of it, well, what was, of course, understood at the time already is that this reassortment, the rate variation is shuffled around by sex, coming from both of the parents. But the problem is that after a long marriage, the sort of variation gets more and more limited. Variation there. And that wasn't understood until sometime later, late in the century and early in the next one, was a source of the new heritable variation. And mutations, some kind of spontaneous change that's random, has nothing to do with what's being selected on. And this was first seen in the wild, of a flower that suddenly appeared, had never seen one before, by de Vries, that was an evening primrose. It was blue rather than yellow, and it suddenly appeared in a field. And then later on in the lab, and really explored much more by Thomas Morgan with one of the now biologists' favorite organisms, Drosophila, a fruit fly. So that was really the basics that were there. But of course, this didn't say where the information was stored and where what it actually for the variation if one looked within the organism. So of course, now we know that the store of genetic information, for a long time that was a black box. And now we have what's inside the black box there, which is the DNA. And so that goes back more than about 60 years now. And the base pairs in there, so these different colors in there, these pairs come in C, G, A, and T, which are paired together in particular ways. And that's all the information that's passed from one organism to its offspring. Okay. So these are all the basic rules that have been known for a while. And there's an enormous number of facts. Okay. So the evidence. Well, the main evidence, and the biggest and most impressive, overwhelming body of evidence is from the fossils and looking at modern species and how they're related to each other. And these are used to construct the phylogenies, the family trees of relatedness, which I'm going to show. Okay. The selection on existing variation, well, a famous case which was from a long time ago was moths in England changing color because of the Industrial Revolution. It's a kind of boring change, though not very many good evidences of changes that one can actually see happening on time when man was recording. So it was a little bit disturbing. But some of the things we've come to know more recently is that, in fact, not only small changes like that, but whole new species and whole enormous ranges of groups of species can actually happen rather. And the cichlid family of fishes in the Great Lakes in Africa is a famous example, which happened over 100,000 years and tremendous radiation, as it's called there, of this kind of diversification. But things can happen on much faster timescales too. Antibiotic resistance in the laboratory, as in here, antibiotic resistance can emerge immediately, easily in a day or sub-part of a day. Antibiotic resistance to new antibiotics introduced for medical purposes, it tends to take sort of years for them to develop and the antibiotic can spread around. You know, we've no idea why. Why is it years? Why isn't it 1,000 years? Domestication of crops. That was something Darwin knew about. That's very rapid evolution. It's driven by very strong selection from humans. Very rapidly, I mean, early on time scales are pretty long, but things can be done in both for crops and animals on much shorter times as well. So these are cases where one can actually see the evolution in action. What about the information stored? These are all at the level of some kind of organismic property that one sees. But the level of information stored, well, that's the mutations in DNA where the bases change. One of them there changes from a G to an A. And one can track down those mutations. One can particularly figure out which mutations cause resistance. And then what one can do is one can take the proteins or that this codes for the DNA or take the DNA itself and compare them and also get phylogenies, and I'll show one of those, and really get a lot of information which amazingly gives you essentially the same as was derived from the fossil record and from the species, even though they're very different kinds of information and in some sense have almost nothing to do with each other. So the fact that you make the same inferences in both of them is pretty remarkable and very, very strong evidence for the basic ideas. Another example of very rapid evolution, an unfortunate one, is evolution in a single person. And this I'm not going to in detail, but this is actually a family tree of HIV starting from one individual virus that came in and then how it evolves in that person over 10 years and diversifies. And it's that evolution, which is battled by the evolution of the immune system, also an evolutionary process, which is likely to kill. So what about the phylogeny? Well, a phylogeny is really a family tree, but it's a family tree that has no dates on it. There's no birth dates and death dates. What it is it's the ancestry, but without the times. And that lack of the times is a really important thing in connection with what's understood and what's not understood. So this is the very article from 1866. And you notice sort of it's put in the form of a tree. And up at the top there, you know, even in capital letters, is man. This idea of the evolution, you know, culminating in our wondrous selves. Well, things are a bit different now. The phylogeny is now mainly derived from DNA sequences, finding a lot of other information. And so a particular comparison which are done to really get a lot of this tree is by looking at the RNA from ribosomes, and that's coded in the DNA, and ribosomes are the machinery that turns the information from the DNA to make the proteins. So the ribosome is really the crucial connection that turns the information into the machinery that's going to run the cell and the organism. And one can also look at then proteins, which many organisms have in common, or sometimes essentially all of them have in common. And this is actually looking at the sequence of amino acids that the DNA codes for. In blue here are common across all these organisms, from human to bacteria, yeast, tomato, and by what these differences are, you can start to infer how these are related to each other. This is bits of proteins, not enough to really do very much, but it already gives one some. Now, if you look at this, you have to kind of wait, where did the humans go? Okay, well, way up in the top corner there, there's animals. And so this is the organism that considers itself to be the most important on Earth. If you look in a different part of the tree, you find the organism that is on Earth, or the group of organisms, which are the cyanobacteria. Okay. If the cyanobacteria didn't evolve, or something like the cyanobacteria, we wouldn't be here. And an enormous number of other things wouldn't be here either. The cyanobacteria are what evolved a way to do photosynthesis, to use energy from the light. That had evolved before, but they evolved in the way to do it with getting the hydrogen from water. There's enormous amounts of water. When they do that, it releases the oxygen. and the atmosphere, which had very little oxygen in it before, gets oxygen in it. So therefore, animals that can breathe, things basically burn, you get much more efficient metabolism, and all the energy that one needs to make multicellular organisms that go around comes from the cyanobacteria. Now, at some point, the cyanobacteria got kind of lazy, and they said, look, why do we have to do all the work of making all the structures as well? So they invented plants, and there the chloroplasts in plants are originally from cyanobacteria, and essentially your cyanobacteria descendants are responsible essentially for photosynthesis on Earth. Okay. So that was the most important, maybe single innovation since the cell, early cells, and is really what made the life as we know it. So you know, on this kind of tree, you pretty clearly see that we don't look very important, and especially if we evolve into this this form here. Okay. One other thing I should say is that most of the proteins which are used to infer this from, they're really boring proteins. Right? I mean, if you look at fossils, you try to understand the interesting parts and how they evolve. Sometimes you use like teeth and you follow those and subtle changes are important, but you try to understand the whole organism. But here, you can't do that. You have to follow the bits of DNA, which are the ones that you can follow. So they have to be there in all organisms. And those are usually the most boring things. So the things you're using to make this tree have very little to do with any of the interesting evolution that happened. They're just sort of markers and sort of labels. Okay, so that's always an important thing to remember as well. There's very little connection that we understand between the change in the DNA and the changes in the organisms. Okay, so once one's got the basic laws, then you know, if one's a string theorist, that's it. So Joe can leave, other people can go home. But the basic laws, anything can evolve. The basic laws are enough to evolve anything. The only question is how fast. Okay. Well, antibiotic resistance can be a single mutation that happens very quickly. A spontaneous cell forming from nothing, or even a spontaneous human forming from nothing. If you wait long enough, that can happen as well and be selected on. Now, you know, people laugh, and somewhere between those two are the kind of evolutionary changes that can happen on timescales that happen on Earth, on billions of year timescales. Right? But where is that boundary? You know, what sets what timescales things happen? Now, one has to divide things into two categories. It's very difficult to talk about things, even though physicists love to, like what's the probability of life on other planets. Okay? And the problem is we only have one example of it. As far as we know, the origins of both metabolism, using energy and making things by cells, and reproduction only happened once on Earth. And we don't know everything that's happening anywhere else. Okay? Origins of a cell, again, we only know that it's, as far as we know, it only happened once. Oxygen-producing photosynthesis, I already mentioned. Okay? But there are many other things, which a lot of us would consider much more impressive, which had happened many times. Multicellular organisms, plants, animals, and many other kinds have evolved separately. Okay? Eyes, at least 10 different times, some people would say 30 or 40, have evolved separately. Okay? Intelligence, well, this one people get upset by. If you say that you're much more impressed by the difference between a chimp and the intelligence of a bacteria than you are between the difference between a chimp and us, then you would say, I would say that higher intelligence or almost higher intelligence had evolved many times. Chimps, possibly dolphins, parrots, and actually ravens, and octopus, which are very far away, all by various measures, these ones particularly, and the ravens are comparably intelligent with chimp. And you know, chimp, one can argue, is on the border of higher intelligence, which is obviously a different subject for a neuroscience workshop here rather than an evolution one. So many things that one thinks of as being very special have evolved lots of times. Okay? So as soon as something has evolved lots of times, one can start talking about what are the sort of probabilities that are occurring, what are the rates, what does one expect? So particularly, how long will the times will it take? Antibiotic resistance, new species, typically a million years, but sometimes much shorter. Major innovations, whole new body types and things like that, well, hundreds of millions of years, maybe tens, maybe a billion, we don't really know, but those are the long time scale. Unfortunately, except for these small changes, we have very little direct evidence of these changes actually happening. But those are the most crucial thing. In essence, evolution is a dynamical process. We have all this nice history, ancestry, but we really want to understand the actual changes. So we really want to know, what do the timescales depend on? What is it that sets the timescales for the evolution? And then more importantly, can one make quantitative predictions? And of course, one would like to make testable quantitative predictions. So at this point, one can ask, what was the problem with the books? Who cares about quantitative understanding? So Richard Dawkins, many of you may have read some things about, and he has written about quantitative things, and particularly this was actually a commentary on an article about estimating the time to evolve a vertebrate eye, one of the things which puzzled Darwin and has puzzled many people since. Okay? And he would first say, well, what is the question? What's the use of half an eye? People will ask. But then there's rest of it. Speaking of the physicist, engineer, etc., I cannot believe that there's been enough time for an organ as complicated as eye to evolve from nothing. Both questions stem what I have unkindly called the argument from personal incredulity. Audiences nevertheless appreciate an answer, and I have usually fallen back on the sheer magnitude of geological time. Okay, so the life's been around a long time, there's been a long time to evolve. That's the important thing. Okay? Okay, why long time? Why not the size of the Earth? Okay, I call this, unkindly, the argument for personal innumeracy. Okay? And unfortunately, Richard Dawkins and many others don't understand what they don't understand. Okay, what about someone else? Well, J.B.S. Haldane, who was one of the ones responsible for what's called the modern synthesis of evolution, which is a little disturbing, that's 100 years ago. And what he said is that a satisfactory theory of natural selection must be quantitative in order to establish the view that natural selection is capable of accounting for the known facts of evolution. We must show not only that it can cause a species to change, but that it can cause it to change at a rate which will account for present and past transmutation. And interestingly enough, Darwin himself actually had quantitative worries. He thought that selection seemed to be a very slow process, would take a rate, and he was very puzzled because he was told by physicists that the Earth was only 20 or 30 million years old. And he thought, geez, that's not actually long enough time. I'm surprised things can happen that fast. As far as I can tell, the amount of worrying about such things by the evolution biologists since then has been rather less, which is rather troublesome. So how long are the evolutionary timescales? Okay, well, they're actually, in some real sense, not that long, and I'm going to do this a bit by analogy. So the earliest life is not much less long than the age of the Earth, about 4 billion years. The age of the universe is only somewhat of years. So I plotted things on a logarithmic scale here. At this end is a time for our purposes, of our immediate ones, of evolution for us is 100 years, is the obviously shortest from one order of generation. Human civilizations, 10,000 years. Separation between human and chimps, a few million years, each going up a factor of 100. Extinction of dinosaurs, 100 million. Multicellular life, 500 million or so. Earliest bacteria, a few billion. And then the age of the Earth and the age of the universe in there. Okay, so it's a big range, but it's not that big. It's a range that's perfectly within things that we're comfortable with. If you look here, if I consider this to be a year since the earliest life, then that translates to 100 years being a second. Okay. So this is not that big a range. These are numbers that many people are pretty comfortable with. They're not really very large numbers. Okay, so worrying about saying that time is responsible for everything, it's not at all clear how much that makes sense. Now, a really important observation is that all of these timescales, okay, with the exception of the extreme short, are coming from a combination of geophysics and radiochemistry. The timelines are entirely associated with physics, and they have no biological understanding involved at all. Okay, so the timescale all come from other areas. Now, I've sometimes asked evolutionary biologists, I said, supposing the physicists and the radiochemists got together and realized they'd made a mistake in units, as NASA has occasionally, and they really messed up, and they found out that actually life was 10 to the 100th years old rather than 10 to the 10th. Would it bother anyone? And the honest people I've talked to said, no, we don't understand evolutionary timescales enough to tell the difference between 10 to the 100th years and 10 to the 10th. Okay. So this is even worse than string theory level accuracy, right? We don't understand it on log level. Then I ask, well, what about if it's 10 to the 10 to the 10 years? Well, then they, I think, get a little bothered by that. And in fact, they should be bothered, because at that time, all kinds of things could happen just by complete chance. Okay? But these really are quantitative issues, and they're important to think about. But this is not the only one. The age isn't the only one that's important. Okay. So some basic dynamics as to what determines the rates of evolution. So what's usually emphasized, I already mentioned, is selection. The Darwin word about, the Dawkins always talks about that. If you actually want to know what about this paper that Dawkins is referring to here, asking afterwards, it's almost too embarrassing for even me to say in public, especially if it's being recorded. It's pretty disturbing. So what is the selection? Well, this is the measure of the reproductive fitness. If you start with organisms here, which are Labradors, which on my screen are yellow, here they're white. And then people at some point started to like chocolate Labradors, and so the number that bred got more, the time went up, they were being artificially selected on BIOS. So that was, and how fast they go depends on how much like selective pressure I can do in the breeding. But the problem is, The problem is that it takes, I have to get one chocolate lab in the first place. Okay? And that's a result of a mutation, and the novel mutation can take a very long time to occur, and the reason is that mutation rates are very small, and I'm going to say how small they are in a minute. Okay? So it's not clear this is the time scale set by that, it's longer before you get the first one you can select on, and the evolution needs the variation to select on. Okay? What, however, if I have a lot more dogs? Labradors, there are more than any other of them in the US. Very long, and then even if I didn't have any chocolate ones originally, okay, there's enough of them that one of them is likely to get quite quickly and become a chocolate one, and then the number of chocolate ones takes off. So in this case here, the mutation part of it, the rate is really limited by the selection. Okay? So if we're starting to be concrete, then if population has n individuals, if n is large, then the first mutations occur earlier. If the chance of the mutation per generation, per individual, is m, then n times m is the chance that one of them. And so one question, is that large or small? You know, what circumstance is one in? That obviously depends on the context. What about the selection? Well, a measure is the selective advantage S, and that's fine. So the mutant population will grow exponentially at a rate given by S. So each after T generations, it will be 1 plus S to the T, and this is this classic exponential exponential growth of a beneficial mutation. Okay. So what limits, in practice or any particular context, the rate of evolution? Is it limited by selection? Is it limited by mutation? Is it limited by other factors? Is it limited by a combination of those? And if so, what's the relevant combination? Okay. Rather amazingly, this is not known in almost any context. Even more amazingly, it's not asked in very many contexts either. And that's, they want, the role of the physicists is to ask these kinds of questions. So let's get a sense of some of the numbers in the context most familiar to us, which is in humans. So in the humans, the mutation rate for what's called a point mutation, a change of A, the chance per generation of a particular base changing is about 1 in 100 million, mutation rate of about 10 to the minus 8. If you look how far back we're related to 100 million years or so, separation between us and mice, translates into a difference between the mouse and the human of about 15% of our DNA. We're about 2% different from a chimpanzee, a tenth of a percent from each other, 2% from a chimpanzee, 15% from a mouse, and that's roughly where that those numbers come from. There are also things which are actually much more interesting. Things can duplicate bits of the DNA, bits can drop out, things can be combined from here to over there, be moved around, and those are typically the process that actually can lead to new genes. And initially, it was thought that a mouse and human, after they were sequenced, almost all the genes were in common. But now it's gone up. Now they think about 20% of the genes aren't in common between a mouse and a human. And we've no idea what those ones do. And they're probably the most interesting ones. So this is one of the problems with not trying to understand evolution. What about the numbers? Well, this is a very small number, but the number of humans is very large. Close to 10 to the 10th. I guess it'll saturate around 10 to the 10th. So if we then look at a particular mutation and ask, how often does that occur? Well, if we look across a whole human population, it'll occur about once a year, every mutation. So every possible mutation that could occur in the human genome occurs somewhere in the world about once a year, okay, with the birth of a new baby. Okay. Now, of course, it's not just one possible mutation. There are an enormous number of possible ones. What is the length of the genome of humans is about 3 billion base pairs. So that's a very large number. That's the number of possible mutations. But then, of course, a crucial question is how many of those are beneficial? How many of those are beneficial to us now? How many of those are beneficial to our ancestors when they were starting to become human and so on? We haven't the faintest idea. Okay. We don't know how many mutations have happened in the past that we see evidence for. How many of those are beneficial? How many of them didn't do much? And just sort of hitchhiking along. Okay. So let's come to some more general questions, and they're all about numbers. Okay. Mutation rates. Why are mutation rates so low, 10 to the minus 8? Or maybe I should ask, why are they so high? If I have it in a human, there's tens of mutations that occur in each generation. And if some of those are bad, that seems too high a number. So why are they low or high, and what should I compare it with? Low or high compared to what? Genome sizes. Genomes are big, but much to everyone's surprise, when they sequence the human genome, we don't have that many genes. We only have 20,000 or so genes. But in some real sense, it seems like 20,000 or not much more than that. It's enough to do anything, to make all kinds of incredibly complex life. Bacteria, you know, 5,000 genes or so, might have some a bit more. It's not that much different. Very simple model organisms have not that many different than us. So somehow, that sort of numbers of words or that number of sentences or something is enough to do with anything. We've no idea why or why it's that ballpark. You know, why not 1,000 or why not 1,000,000? We've no idea. Sex. Sex is very popular. It's very popular, including among organisms that aren't usually thought to have sex, like bacteria, but they will exchange DNA, or at least one of them will give up some DNA, another one will pick it up, or pick it up from a dead bacteria. Sex has a lot of drawbacks. There's a woman having offspring to propagate her genes, has to on average of two offspring, one male, one female, and then the daughter can have two more, one male, one female, the daughter has two more. But if the woman has men around, and the woman could just reproduce, then she would have two girls, and they would have two offspring. She would have four granddaughters, eight great-granddaughters, and so on. And she, tremendous advantage to not having males around, as far as females are concerned, and as far as the species are concerned. But there are some other disadvantages, longer-term ones associated with evolution, which are not understood. And there's all kinds of controversies about them. And I and various and Boris Schreiman and others around have worked a bit on that in some very simple context. So there, balance between the drawbacks and advantage, quantitative thing, is not understood even in simple context. The size of the Earth. I mentioned Dawkins says geological time. What about geological size? Why should the size of the Earth matter? Well, the bigger the Earth is, the more organisms there are. The more organisms there are, the more chances some of them get interesting mutations. So that's one part of it. Another part is how long things take to spread. So one of the things that could set some of the evolutionary timescales, like antibiotic resistance arise, is actually how long it takes to spread out of the hospitals and around other cities and around the world before we really notice it. So it could be that's in fact a limiting factor. And that also then couples back to all kinds of other things. So this is also a way of putting it, which I will also ask people. I will say, well, you sort of think we understand the time scale. Okay, I'm okay with that. But let's ask about this one. Supposing the Earth were 1,000 times smaller, but with similar diversity of environment, 1,000 times larger with similar diversity environment. Would one expect evolution to have proceeded faster, that we would get more diversity in the Earth, or what? I don't know. But that's, you know, that's the kind of question one has to ask if one wants to actually try to understand things. Because you might naively think, well, 1,000 times as big, the evolution might be 1,000 times as fast. You've got many more individuals that can evolve in interesting ways. Okay. Fitness. That's one of the most loaded words, so loaded like quotes. One thinks of the fitness as being one thing, reproductive success. If you have more offspring, you do better. That's a short-term fitness, faster reproduction, but of course also survival. You can reproduce very rapidly, but if all your offspring die suddenly, that's important as well. So fitness is very much not one quantity. On the intermediate term, avoiding extinction as a species. That's important. On the longer term, if I think of from the purpose of mammals, you know, are mammals successful? The fitness of mammals as a group, or primates as a group? We could drive ourselves extinct with nuclear war or some other ways, well, easy, and we would not have been successful even in the intermediate term. But it may be that primates are still going to be successful, or the animals are still going to be successful, and that's associated with the evolving into new niches and new species and so on. So this is all a matter of time scales, matter of local things versus global, and so on. This is a much trickier one. How many sort of different ways are there to evolve? How many routes are there to higher fitness in the given conditions? How many different ecological niches are there? The concept of a niche, if this organism fills this niche, there's some other niche available, so another one can evolve to fill this niche, and they kind of bump into each other, and there can't be there can't be too many. Okay. So these are questions which some of them have been making precise, not really know how to do. Some of them one starts knowing how to do. Okay. Very important caveat about everything's evolution, and it really warps a lot of the understanding, particularly about this word, evolvability. We only see things which were long-term successful. If organisms only ever had very small numbers, like a lot of nice fuzzy animals we see today, probably including cheetahs, we would never see them in the fossil record if they existed a long time ago. Okay, and only the one that groups of organisms are successful enough to have got to huge numbers, left fossils, or even more, to have diversified and left a whole variety of descendants of all kinds, are the ones we see. So everything that we see and conclude is conditional upon things being so successful. And things that are normally successful are different than average things. Right? And a lot of times it sort of seems as if they were systematically improving, but in fact it's just the lucky ones one sees. And one suspects this of a lot of people who make money on the stock market. you know more about that than I do, but okay. So this is another one. And then if any of these things, you know, how do I really quantify this? How do I turn this into a concrete, which I can put some numbers? Okay. So what are the difficulties? Evolution dynamics is a very complicated process. It occurs at multiple levels. Genetic changes give rise to changes in proteins. They give rise to properties of the organism. That's already two levels, or up, or even ones in between. What determines the fitness at that time is the interaction between the organism and the environment. It really is a fit to the environment. It's not an absolute set. Okay. Well, of course, then things are fitter. The populations change, or which ones are in the population changes, and that goes back and changes the environment. Right, we certainly do that, but bacteria do that much more than we do, like making all the oxygen. And the ecology changes, the interactions between the organisms. But of course, this feeds back on the fitness, it feeds back on the properties of the organisms, the new environment, and all this links together at many levels. So it's a very complicated process, and we understand very little about connections between these levels, or the things we do understand are often, one can see, are drastically oversimplified. Okay. DNA sequencing, it's wonderful. But it's a bit like, so far, it's a bit like the transistor. That after the transistor was invented, for a long time, everyone just did the same things they were doing before, but with transistors instead of vacuum tubes, and they got smaller. And it wasn't until integrated circuits, and even quite a long time after that, that the transistor revolution really erupted and made things different. Okay. And I think it's true that the DNA sequencing revolution hasn't borne fruit yet. It's people are still mainly doing what they did, so much sequencing. And the sequencing costs have come down so enormously that there's much more we can do with that, and I'm going to say just a few things about that. Experiments, evolution experiments, people have tried for a long time. Domestication of crops, of course, is one of them. They're hard, they're slow, they're difficult to generalize from to make something. But they're absolutely crucial. If we do experiments, we're not going to really understand this. Computer simulations, evolution's a great field for computer simulations. You write down a little model, you run it on the computer, and you see something interesting. But inferring something about connection with reality from the fact that you see something interesting is very dangerous. So it's much too easy to do, much too hard to learn anything from, much too easy to get published. And one of the most crucial things, even if you thought your model was pretty good, you would have to be able to extrapolate from the number of organisms you can handle on the computer to the much bigger numbers that are out there in the wild, or to the much longer time scale. So the issue of extrapolation is absolutely crucial in many of doing things with computers, but particularly in this one. What about theory? Well, the most important part is really getting at the questions, asking the quantitative questions. Models, there's some around for a while, some of them are even relevant. They turn out to be quite difficult to analyze, and that's been a fun task for theoretical physicists. But for those also, it's very hard to generalize and to extrapolate, but at least one can try, and we're starting to be able to do that in simple context. But then, of course, one would like to connect the theory to reality, and that's always one of the biggest challenges, and then one would like to have the theory affect this and affect that and so on, and nice feedback between all these levels to combat all the feedback between those levels. If you really want to understand evolution, okay, now people, you know, I say people think we're important, they think mammals are important, but bacteria are much more important. They change the world much more important than us. So if you really want to study evolution and do experiments and things, you've got to learn to love bacteria. And I'll explain in a minute what, and also other microbes. They're tiny, so you have enormous numbers of them. Their genomes are small, so you can sequence them very creaply. To sequence a bacterial genome now, ballpark of $1. Okay, incredibly cheap. The whole human genome now for a new person is less than $1,000. It was a few billion dollars for the first one. Reproduction fast from minute scales to days. You can manipulate them. You can change the DNA in bacteria and make them do different things. And you can probe them in all kinds of ways, some of which are getting clever and clever and more useful for understanding. The other thing about bacteria is they have incredible diversity. They do all kinds of different things, and there are all kinds of different numbers. If you look at, you will find that the highest level of diversity, tens of different phyla, many hundreds of different species, tens of different phyla, completely different groups of organisms, some of which there are no known examples of those organisms, except perhaps a bit of DNA from some hot springs in Yellowstone. Okay. So there were very weird things even you find there. If you look at a low level, here's the hot springs in Yellowstone. Okay. This Yellowstone has microbial mats in it, and they're very high temperatures, and at different temperatures you get slightly different things, and here's a piece sliced taken out of the mat, a few centimeters here, and there's a little thing on the top which is green. Well, green usually means something's photosynthesizing, and that's some of these cyanobacteria, a particular one cyanobacterial species which lives there and was isolated and was sequenced. And we've been looking with collaborators at this and actually trying to understand what's there by doing sequencing from a whole big population, but of this one species. There's at least 100 subtypes in there, probably all doing different things, but they look identical, and we can't tell And they're persistent. The next spring has a large fraction of the same ones, and the next year, and so on. What on earth is it doing? What is all this bacterial diversity? Why is there so much? And that's just something really boring. They're all doing the same thing, simple niche, and so on. Okay. So once one gets to bacteria, we don't just have large numbers. We have colossal numbers. And colossal numbers that all physicists, except maybe astrophysicists, are also uncomfortable with. We don't have really good way of thinking. I can't do like the analogy from a second to a year, being for the time scales, because these numbers are too big. The number of bacteria in you is about 10 to the 15. The number of your own cells is about 10 to the 14. So you are outnumbered by the bacterial cells in you. Most of them would do quite well without you. You would not do very well without them. Okay. What about if I go everywhere? Well, if we look at the total number of bacteria on Earth, the estimates are 10 to the 29 to 1. Big uncertainties there, at least a factor of 100. Okay. If I take those bacteria, by the way, and you stick them all in a row, they would stretch across the universe, roughly. Did I get the number right? We'll let Lars check that number. Okay, the total number of bacteria ever lived, I don't think you need this one. Ever lived, well, I ask how long the bacteria take before they divide. Well, days, years, sometimes longer, sometimes minutes. If you put in a range of numbers, the estimate of the total number of bacteria that ever lived is up in this enormous numbers here, 10 to the 39 to 10 to the 43. Okay. Why is this a relevant number? This is the total number of evolution experiments ever done. Okay, and that's comparable to the total number done on any kinds of organism. This is a really enormous number. Now, an important thing is to notice, where does that number come from? This number comes from the time the bacteria have been around, particularly the number of generations. That's of order 10 to the 12th, is not that big a number. Okay, and this huge number here. So most of this big number, which is determining the number of evolution experiments, is determined by the size of the Earth rather than how old the Earth is. Okay, and in some sense, it's sort of two-thirds or of that large number. So that's really important, the fact that there's enormous numbers of these organisms. Okay. If I look at the size of the genomes, they're more modest, but not that much different as far as numbers of genes. The number of possible bacterial genomes is just ridiculous. Okay. The mutation rates, they're very good at reproducing their bacteria, at reproducing their DNA. Some of them, the error per base per cell division is in this range. This one here means that a bacteria can replicate its DNA thousands of times without any errors at all. Okay. It's pretty impressive. And there's an interesting question as to why would it want to do so well? And that's not known. Okay. What if I look at trying to explore genome space? Right? This is an enormous number of possible DNA sequences. Obviously, it doesn't explore all of them. But maybe it's at least explored all possible proteins or something. No, that's not possible. If I look at a little protein, a part of a protein that does something, about 30 amino acids, maybe about a few percent of a size of a typical protein, one little functional part called domain. The number of possible protein domains is about 10 to the 39, which is the same order as this. So even if you just produced completely random DNA anytime you made more, it still wouldn't have explored all the possible protein domains. So there's a huge redundancy. There's got to be many different ways of doing the same things, and that's one of the really important aspects. Okay. Well, we don't know which numbers matter, which of these. We don't know which are important. We'd like to know. Why might the large numbers of the populations be important? Okay. Well, if I take a single species, this is the most predominant cyanobacteria on Earth. There's estimated about 10 to the 27th of these. They're responsible for a substantial fraction of all the photosynthesis. This prochlorococcus has a switch between day and night, as you'd obviously want if you're a bacterium that lives off the light from the sun. Some other cyanobacteria are known to have a circadian clock that actually keeps track of time. Okay. Could this evolve a circadian clock in a reasonable time? Okay. So I'm going to put down a completely imaginary scenario, but just to show you how very rare things could in principle be relevant. Okay. So in this scenario, supposing originally this was the DNA and the original switch was okay, it worked fine. Okay. Then it had a mutation in it and the switch wasn't good anymore. So that would be a bad mutation. But if it duplicated this bit and had that mutation, then maybe it could sort of oscillate, but it grew slowly. So it's maybe started to keep a bit of time, but it grew too slowly. That was bad. But if it had these two and the deletion, then it had a circadian clock. And that anticipates dawn, and that's a big advantage. Okay. Now, of course, it's a completely imaginary scenario. But the crucial thing about this is it has several bad steps. So you'd think this can't happen by evolution, because I have to do one thing, that's bad, forget it. I have to do three here. But when I have a really big number of organisms, even if I say the probability of each of these processes is 10 to the minus 9, so then I've got to get 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 9, that's 10 to the minus 27. So the probability of this all happening in one go, in one cell division, is about 10 to the minus 27. There's 10 to the 27 per chlorococcus. This happens every day, an event with three things happening all at the same time. Okay? So you can get really, really rare things coming in evolution. But this is not the right number. Of course, even if there was some route sort of like this to a circadian clock, there are many other routes. And there are many other different ways that the proteins can change. We have no idea how many. If we want to take this chance of it happening, we've got to multiply by the number of different ways you can get there. That's some enormous number. Probably not as enormous as 10 to 27, but it's an enormous number. And that's the relevant number times this. This is just one particular way. So these big numbers get very quickly, and really, particularly of big evolutionary changes, they're absolutely... So now I'm going to turn to evolution writ small, and this is the one thing which I've made a minor contribution to. Can one ever predict the rate of some real evolutionary process, not something imaginary like I just did? So the simplest ones one can imagine is evolution, asexual, no complications of sex, a constant environment. I don't have to worry about what the fitness is. If everything is growing exponentially, the fitness is just the birth minus the death rate, and it's really clear what's being selected on. And in a situation where there are many beneficial mutations available, potential beneficial mutations the organ can get. And what I'm interested in is sort of the speed of evolution, which is the rate of increase of the fitness. How fast does the fitness increase as this population evolves? In the conventional picture, this is mutation limited. I will get one beneficial mutation coming into the population, like the chocolate lab. That'll grow into the population, it'll sweep through the population, take over, and then another beneficial mutation will come in on those ones, get even better, and that'll sweep through. If this is the case, then the rate of increase of the fitness is proportional to the population size, the total rate from beneficial mutations, and then something which is involved how strong the selection is. What this means is if I take a population from 1,000 to 1,000,000, the speed will be 1,000 times faster. The population makes a huge difference. But now, suppose I instead go to very large populations. Very large populations, some of them require one beneficial mutation, some require another. Many mutations they're getting at once. These mutations compete with each other. They can't all come in, but they also can add. One individual can get a mutation, and then its descendants get another mutation. Right? So they can add to each other. And there's something complicated balance. We've got mutations coming in, but they're not limited because a lot of them, but they're competing. And then we've got things adding together, and that helps. So that's sort of more selection. And there's got to be some kind of balance in there. And it ends up turning out that the speed, instead of growing proportional to the population, it only grows logarithmically in the population. And that means that the gain you get from being a big population is not very much. Going from 1,000 to 1,000,000, the speed only doubles instead of going up by a factor of 1,000. Well, this is, at least at the level of very simple toy models, not realistic models, one can make a prediction. And this model just is in it. It's got the population size, the total beneficial mutation rate, and the selective advantage of the mutations, which are all assumed to be the same. This is a toy theoretical physicist model. Okay. So this is a concrete prediction. So Michael Desai, who was in many ways the one who really got me interested in evolution, was a string theory student at Harvard who saw the light and got interested in evolution. Actually, he already was when he came to Harvard, and did some theory. And then he thought, okay, for a summer project, he'll go and try the experiment and test it. So he went to Andrew Murray's lab, yeast geneticist's colleague, who I think was here a few years ago. And he said, okay, I'm going to do an experiment to test the dependence on the population size and on the mutation rate. Okay. And so what he looked at was yeast, the yeast genetics lab, with low sugar, so the yeast will evolve to do better without much food, and in a situation which was very crucial to keep the populations always growing exponentially. So you have to, they grow exponentially, of course, they run out of room, so you've got to dilute them and keep them growing exponentially. And you have to do this on 14-hour cycles, 22-hour cycles, and 26-hour cycles all at the same time, which is a pain in the neck. But fortunately, Michael doesn't have a functioning system. Bother him doing all these things on weird hours. Anyway, as often one expects with an experiment, this was not a summer project. It took several years, and Michael developed into a fantastic experimentalist. He's now a professor of biology at Harvard, and he's one of the unusual ones where the theorists consider him a theorist and the experimentalists consider him an experimentalist. It's usually the other way around. Okay. So what the basic thing we measured after 500 generations was the rate of increase of the fitness, how much it increases per generation. And against, well, I'm plotting this on a logarithmic scale because it's of a big range, the population times a mutation rate. And it turns out there are two strains we can do. One has higher mutation rates than others. And one looks at the sort of conventional view, one mutation at a time, looks like this. The theory is here, and the experiments are scattered around. So the one crucial thing, it's clear that this completely disagrees with the traditional theory. You can say, OK, this agreement isn't very good, but there are actually only two parameters for this data. Still not very good, but you can go and measure fitness distributions. So you can take a population, you can measure the fitness of a lot of individuals from it. And then you can do this theory for that, this predictions for that, and then you can do much better at testing things, and you can rule out various other possibilities. And you end up concluding that the experimental results are in agreement with a theoretical prediction. But they shouldn't have been. The theory was a stupid, simple model that assumed that every mutation came in had the same fitness advantage, and then they added on top of each other. Well, we know there's all kinds of fitness advantages. So there's no way that this should have agreed with the theory. It was a toy model. Maybe some things are similar, but it shouldn't. And really, in biology, even more than other areas, the role of theory is to be wrong. Well, if you do a complicated model and simulation, it's too easy to get things that fit data, look like data. It's much more useful if you're wrong, and then you say, ah, but wait, you told me that assumption, that something's wrong with one of those assumptions, and you can then stimulate some other experiment or start learning from it. Okay? So this was a case we hadn't expected to be right. It was embarrassingly good. And this actually led to then quite a lot of work to try to think about, well, why did it work? And here's something we have a lot of experience from physics, is that oftentimes when numbers get big, when you get large number of atoms that make up something, and large number of individuals when you're looking at societies, a lot of things don't depend on all the details. You sort of get collective behavior, some emergent behavior in sort of big words, and some things don't depend on all the details. So what we now understand is it's in very simple context of evolution, of asexual evolution in a constant environment, that there is really a certain amount of universality, and that's coming from the fact that there are big numbers. There are big numbers of the number of possible beneficial mutations, the number of directions it can go in to evolve. That's a number which is much larger than was expected before we did the experiment, the simple context. And then there's big numbers of the size of the population. And those two together make it that actually quite a lot of things are more general. The S we pull out from the fit isn't to do with the fitness of the sort of typical mutation that comes in, but it's the ones that dominate. So we actually now have led, this led to some understanding that certain things in this incredibly simple context have something which, you know, we like as physicists, of some amount of universality, not depending on all the detail. And one of the general hopes is that when one's got big numbers around, that that's going to happen at least sometimes, even with all the complexities of biology. Okay. So this is really the most boring evolution experiment ever done, probably the most boring one could think of. But as far as I know, it was about the first one where there was actually a prediction, and then the experiment confirmed it, even though you had to go back and scratch your head and say, you know, why did it? But this is really boring evolution. It's growing in conditions it's grown in the lab for ages and wild. Before that, it's not very interesting things going on. It's just growing a tiny bit faster. Okay, but it is the basic, the essence of the simplest evolutionary process. Okay, so one of the things one would like to ask, though, is I said the mutation rates seem to be higher, the number of beneficial mutations higher than people expected. There are many different genes that we expect they came in here, but we don't know which. Okay. So come on, try to do an experiment and actually follow that directly. Okay. So this was done by Olivier Tenayon and his collaborators recently, and they looked at the biologist's favorite bacterium that lives in your gut, E. coli, and they looked at putting it at somewhat high temperature. It likes to live at body temperature. You put it somewhat high, it doesn't do as well, but it can survive. And they looked at 150 different test tubes with this in and followed them for 2,000 generations. But then the DNA sequencing cost had dropped hugely from the few years ago when we did the experiment to this. And so you have one individual from each line, and you sequence from that. So you sequence one from each line, and you look at the differences. Now, they could have done much better than that. They actually could have taken hundreds of individuals from each and sequenced those, but they didn't, were at that stage quite yet. By next year, they would be. And so they did this, and they found a large number of mutations. They found a lot of point mutations I talked about, insertions and deletions of bits of DNA, some duplications, some more complicated things about things moving around, and then some whole big bits and pulled out. So a lot of different things they saw. But one of the amazing things, and this is the relevant part, is all these mutations, one can pretty much argue, were beneficial that they found. Otherwise, one wouldn't see them. They found about 600 different ones just in these single clones from each. And they were in 400 different genes. Okay? E. coli only has 4,000 or so genes, of which about 1,500 is no known function. thing for the best studied organism. 400 of them have mutations in them which are beneficial in this environment. It's probably many more than that, but these ones have ones that are big enough to actually come in and not get outcompeted by others. And not only these different genes, but if you look at sort of functional things of what's understood about the functions of different bits of the E. coli, these are sort of in roughly 50 different sort of functional modules that do different things. So there are an enormous number of ways just to respond to this high stress. Okay. So huge range of evolutionary routes, but these are kind of boring. They're pretty small effects. Okay. But there is a very important lesson already here. Okay. And this is this. There's a huge range of evolutionary routes. So since there's at least some physicists in the audience, and those rest of you probably know how to tolerate physicists at least, I'm going to tell a physicist's story, but my experience at least resonates a bit more broadly. So there's an actual true story of a qualifying exam for a physics student, and he was asked a general question, as one often is, and he was asked, how would you measure the height of a building with a barometer? You know, what he was supposed to say, well, I'd measure the pressure at the bottom, and I'd measure the pressure on the roof, and then I'd figure out from that what the height was, because pressure goes down with height. But he said, no, I would throw the barometer off the top of the building and measure how long it took to hit the ground. That's a hell of a lot easier way to do it. Right? And so he was failed on that part, but then the professor realized that this was a little unfair, and so he called another professor to sort of re-examine that part, and she then wrote down the story, and I'm sure it's been embellished since, but the basis of it is true. So she asked him, well, what other ways would you do it? He said, well, I would measure the length of shadow of the building and of the barometer, I would get it from that. He said, well, what about another way? Well, I would go and use a ruler going up the stairs. And she said, well, what about something that involves more interesting physics? She said, oh, I would swing it around my head, measure it for the pendulum frequency on the bottom and on the top of the building, and then the gravitational force is a little bit different on the top and the bottom, and infer it from that. So she said, what about something that uses its value as a barometer? So he said, I would go to the superintendent of the building and tell him that if you tell me how tall this building is, I'll give you this really nice barometer. So at this point, she said, okay, you pass. But then as they were walking out of the room, she said, well, you know, surely you know the right answer. He said, I certainly know what answer you want, but I see absolutely no reason I should give it. Okay? And all of one's experience with evolution in the lab, even in the most trivial circumstances, is that you think you're selecting on something and the organism decided to do something else. They solve a different problem, but which does well. And the first example of this, a well-studied one, was discovered by a physicist, Leo Szilard, who was the one who realized you could make an atomic bomb. And also the first one, I think, tried to stop the atomic bomb being dropped. And he was doing some evolution experiments in what was called a chemostat, where you put the organisms in a vat, and you put food in, and you drain out, whatever organisms are there. So if you grow more rapidly, there are more of you, less of you get drained out. And so you're selecting them and going fast. And this is very nice, and you run them, people did. But what did he find? That wasn't what the bacteria did. They evolved to stick to the walls. Right? They found a different solution. Doesn't matter. So when you're doing some particular kinds of stress, and you find there are many possibilities, biologists then love to go and they want to find mechanisms. They want to find what is the story behind these. But if you, in one simple conditions, you want to get the story behind things in at least 400 genes, plus the genes they interact with, you have to explain, you're already having to use a substantial fraction of the whole genome in order to explain these things. And at that point, a more important lesson is surely that there are just very large numbers of possible ways, rather than trying to explain any particular one. This, however, is very nice, but it's still kind of, you know, basic boring evolution, right? It's just growing at high temperature. What about something that has many more aspects of actual evolution? I'm calling this comprehensive because in some ways it has all the features that come in. Okay. So this is experiments by Finkel and by Coulter. They took a single clone of E. coli, or like sealed them in a test tube, so they were starving. And what they found, today, you got new mutations, you got selective sweeps, they would take over the population. These modified the environment because they were eating different things, and there's no new food. So after a very short time, they have to start eating the dead ones, eating each other, which they don't normally do. You get new catabolism, they learn how to eat different things. You get radiation, where many times terms come out, and you get a development and evolution of the ecology. And they followed this then for a couple of years. And on the longer time scales here, you see all these different types, these different colors or different types that have come in. And then you can see some evolve, some disappear, some coexist. And you get all this evolution that goes on. So you get all the basic kind of processes that go on in evolution in a test tube on the scale of a year. Okay, some evolution is really fast. You might also, okay, I don't really care about bacteria eating things. I care about interesting things like multicellular organisms, like us. So what about evolving multicellularity? I said, you know, it happened many times, but, you know, I mean, many meaning dozens maybe. That doesn't mean we can find it quickly. Okay. Well, that's turned out not to be true, and if it was around next week, there's going to be a proper talk on this by... This was starting with yeast, the same organism which we used in other experiments. This is just vineyard. It's been raised in the lab for quite a while. Single-cell organisms, you can see as they're dividing there, it sort of buds off, and then they split. And what they selected them for was to grow fast, to divide rapidly, but also for sedimenting. So they let them sink for a while. They sink to the bottom, and one of you doesn't sink very fast. If you clump together, they were trying to evolve for things to stick together, then you sink faster. And you do that, and you find after a while, you start getting these clumps. They've evolved to stick together. But then it turns out, the rule number one, you didn't get what you thought. They haven't evolved to stick together. What they've evolved to do is not to separate. And these are different ones that evolved in different runs, and they're somewhat different from each other. They grow, they divide, but they don't separate. They grow and divide again. They get these branch structures, but they don't separate. Okay, at least initially, so you get this thing acting like a multicellular organism. You can say, well, you know, why is it multicellular? How does it reproduce? Well, it reproduces. It reproduces by fragmentation. You select on the size by how much you sediment. You can get different sizes. But for a given size you're selecting on, here it is. It's growing. Cells are dividing. They're growing, but they're sticking together. And then at some point it gets to a certain size and it divides off a baby. It goes off. And then this one grows. That actually grows in faster than the parent. And then it grows to sort of similar size and breaks off. And they actually have many variants of these sort of multicellular kind of yeast that evolving and finding various interesting things in them. Now, people will say, okay, yeast is related to multicellular organisms. It sort of knows how to be multicellular already. Maybe. But it is also true, my experience in this field, is that people, evolutionists who are skeptical about experimental evolution, will say, oh, but nothing ever interesting has evolved. Then you'll say, well, what if someone evolved this, like eating some new food source? Oh, that would be interesting. And then someone finds, oh, but that's not really interesting. It's just some other chemical. What about evolving multicellularity? Oh, that'd be really interesting. Well, no, but actually isn't. It's not really interesting. So this is like the issue about intelligence and unique ways in which humans are uniquely intelligent. And then you find a chimp can do that or an octopus can do it, and then you keep raising the bar. Right? But it's clear that one is getting more and more interesting things in the lab. So I just want to conclude with some sort of general comments. One is the connection of evolutionary biology to the rest of biology. Can one understand evolution in terms of cell biology? What makes the mutations or combinations beneficial? The way most biologists tend to think about the organization of biology is sort of modular. This bit does something. It's sort of as if it was designed. It wasn't, but it's as if it was designed. And that's very nice. Explanations for them. Has advantages, very robust. You sort of separate things in this from things over there, and you can transfer whole bits around via sex, which bacteria do it in this way. Okay, so whole sort of functions around. Or it could be that some complicated, messy network of different genes interacting with each other, and if you look at pictures in biology books and papers, they tend to look like that, and that each of the parts maybe has multiple roles. There's not a gene for something, but this gene does this, but it also does that, and it does that as well. Okay. And then how do you sort of explain things? It's not clear what you mean by ordinary biologist explanations from that. Okay. The problem is, with this one, is this. How do you get new functions if everything has a definite function? This seems like it's bad for evolution, or at least for getting new things. It's good for not getting bad things, maybe. This one could give you many possible combinations of things, a lot of interactions going on anyway, and maybe can more easily give you new functions. Okay. So I would say that there's pretty strong evidence that the evolution experiments suggest that at least as far as evolutionary changes, that this is a much better picture. It may be that then further evolution tends to make it go back towards this, but with the interesting evolutionary changes, this is really much better picture, and what we have to really understand is the huge number of evolutionary possibilities. And really, when I start thinking of in sort of statistical terms and things from that. So I just want to then just end with some comments on future prospects and focusing on microbial evolution dynamics, the one that one has best chance of really pushing things. So one more. Do experiments over all kinds of different things: catabolism, eating new things, oscillators like circadian oscillators, multicellular development, all kinds of other things that one can imagine. And one would also like to really include the evolution of the ecology, because that's a crucial part. The organisms change the environment themselves. High throughput ways, genotyping from DNA sequencing, one can now follow dynamics. You can sequence so often in a test tube, you can follow 500,000 individuals in a test tube and how they're evolving. We're doing that now. Okay? You label the individuals by putting a barcode on them, just like in the store. But you put a different barcode in each cell, and then you follow them and the descendant. interpret the barcode. Phenotyping. DNA sequencing got so good that we don't know how to figure out what properties of organisms are changing as the DNA is changing, especially for microbes. So you really need much better ways of following organismic changes. And that also enables you to select on single cells. So you can look for a single cell that has some property and say, I want that one, I'm selecting on that. Like one does with crops or with dogs. Parallel experiments, one really needs statistical information to generalize from that. And the other one, which really hasn't been tried yet, is sort of boosting. If I know there's some very rare process, but it can happen, and some, I can put that into a cell, give it an advantage, but I sort of know how likely it would be to get that, and then look what happens further. So I can combine artificial and natural evolution to really get estimates of rates of much rarer processes that I couldn't possibly see actually happen. In the environment, one would look at dynamics also from sequencing other things, and particularly how things depend on space and time, how they move around. Individual humans already, people are from sequencing looking at coevolution of HIV and the virus and the immune system. And then finally, for this audience, the theory, crucial part of that is really posing the questions for the experiments and the environmental studies. One needs both somewhat realistic models that one can compare or simulate, and also really abstract models. And one has to have sort of the approaches of just playing around with things, and there's not been enough of that in this field. And then one, of course, always faced with the issue of quantitative extrapolation, but at this level, anything can be progress. One, of course, would like to find some general principles. Why does one hope one might be able to? Well, we know from lots of experience in physics that when you've got multiple levels or high complexity, big numbers and things, that those complexities also tend to lead to some simplification. Okay, so that's the sort of hope for the future. And since this is a particular place where this is, I can retitle this last slide in a different way. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. It's wonderful. Questions? More questions?
Objections.
You mentioned maybe a shift in our understanding is, or our methods are necessary toward the end there.
Yeah.
Going from, let's say, a statistics of large numbers of things to looking at paths, if you like, statistics of trajectories.
Yeah.
Is that something that's in the offing? Have people been working toward that?
Well, they're just starting to, and so experiments which are trying to, like these ones, really follow very large numbers of lines at the same time. Paul Rainey, who I'm not sure if is here, doing some experiments on some very interesting selection. I had five slides from his experiment that I have cut at one point recently. And some of those, he finds all kinds of very different possibilities for evolving interesting things. And and so that's one of the things which is starting to come out. Not many people have tried to do it in high throughput ways. Michael Desai is now trying to do that, and he has stacks of plates outside of his office that are about as high as that wall, and all because there's many different parallel evolutions at the same time. And so that people are starting to do that, but the thinking of the questions in that way, I think, hasn't pervaded into the biological community much.
I appreciate, as introverted as you are, that you're able to get the words out to share with us. The timeline that you put on at the beginning.
Yes.
As you know, most of the people in most of the fields involved with that would disagree with most of the numbers, like the age of the universe, the year the dinosaurs went extinct, et cetera, et cetera. I know that was for a symbolic value, but being in a numbers-related thing in a quantitative talk, when
right.
you put out that demo chart early in the talk and so many of the numbers are so far off, it makes me wonder.
I guess I'm not sure which ones you're referring to as being far off.
Well, the Cretaceous extinction was 65 million years ago,
yeah.
not 100 million years ago.
It was on a log scale, and 60 is very close to 100 on a log scale.
Well, and similarly, as you know, some of your colleagues here would indicate that the age of the universe wasn't 10 billion years, but maybe 13 or 14.
Yeah. Well, so this is an important question, because it is a question of what level of understanding does one need before it's appropriate to be quantitative at the level of the difference between 65 and 100, or the difference between 10 and 13. And everything in biology is, essentially nothing in biology is at a stage where being quantitative anywhere near that level matters at all. Okay. This is really things, we don't understand things to factors of 100 in the simple cases, to factors of billions in most of the cases. And so those are small, and I intentionally on a log scale, because those don't make much so much difference. But it really is an important point. One can't try to be quantitative like, say, atomic physicists are, or you know how much accurately you can date things radioactively. There is another clock, which people will tell one, which is a mutational clock. You count the rate of accumulation of mutations, and that's very nice, and you get some similar things. But in some of the best comparisons you could do in that, that clock's uncertain by factors of 10, maybe some in some further comparison, maybe a factor of 100. Factor of 100 is the difference between us separating from the chimpanzees and origin of all multicellular life. So that's a very big factor, but the biological version of the clock is inaccurate at that sort of level. Okay. So these, this, yeah, I mean, thanks to make the point, because it is an important one. So what does one mean by trying to be quantitative? Anything right, the logarithm, if it reasonably well, I'll be happy.
You should have been a master physicist.
Yeah, I know. This is the, or a string theorist. I mean, no.
So let me ask a question. So when you talk about, for example, the E. coli experiment you discussed,
yeah.
Someone like myself who hasn't thought about this yeah. or understands the biology would ask, how long before you would stop calling it E. coli?
Okay, this is a very good question. So in this one, which is, so species in bacteria, the definition of it is completely arbitrary. There's some definition that if things are further apart than 3% of their ribosomal RNA, then they're different species. Okay. So the question is, did it functionally behave differently? These ones that are sealed up in the test tube, after months, they no longer know how to grow fast, divide fast. Now you could evolve them back so they could divide fast. They're doing different things. They really like eating serine, one of the amino acids, much more than they like eating glucose at that stage. So they're really quite different. Okay. But they could probably evolve back to being much more like ordinary E. coli a lot of the time. E. coli can divide very fast in the lab every 20 minutes. And so actually it's a good quick quiz to do on numbers to a biological audience. You know, how many E. coli generations have there been since E. coli were around? And they get the numbers off by orders of magnitude, even though one knows a lot about E. coli. And that's because on average, the E. coli in your gut, you know, they only have room to divide when your gut gets emptied. So they divide about once a day on average. That's a lot longer than 20 minutes. So this bacteria have this tremendous ability to diversify and do all kinds of different chemistry and things. And you know, what one calls them in different species and things is really unclear. So,
Matthew?
Well, so you made references to how challenging using the computer will be because you have numbers like 10 to the 40th.
Yeah.
And so I guess the question would be, you know, what role will computers play? I mean, presumably, you know, you can do things on the computer that you can't do on a pen and paper, so maybe on intermediate scales.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's sort of several roles to sort of do experiments. If you have some idea and you sort of try to see if it works even qualitatively on the sort of toy models, and that's one thing that can be very useful to sort of exploring scenarios. Another one is when you have some theory, but you're really struggling with it. And so Boris Schramann and Richard Neyer and I were struggling with understanding some incredibly simple model, but when there was sex and how much the sex changed the rate of the evolution. And Richard had some simulations, and they were, you know, really well done and in a good regime, and there were a very small number of parameters. But they actually, it turned out what one sort of was starting to conclude from those ended up being wrong, even in that case. But in the end, once we sort of understood it more, we had an idea of how to extrapolate, and then one could really check things also. Or sort of, you know, what phase is something in? What regime is one in? But it's a very big problem generally with any subject is to use computer simulations for doing extrapolation rather than interpolation. And so if one thinks of some experiment, then it's useful, but they tend to get a life of their own, and it's a complicated one. So I guess that one, hopefully, what they won't hold back progress by too much. And they're great, of course, you need them. The cost, by the way, if you want to sequence your own DNA, so you want to get someone to do it, the main cost is the computing. Actual DNA sequencing is a small part of it. The main cost is the computing. And so huge amounts of these things, tremendous amount of computational things have gone in to make all of this stuff possible.
I've heard of evolutionary algorithms being used on computers as an optimization strategy. Do you think that the evolutionary algorithms make a decent inspiration for toy models?
Yeah, that's a very. I think maybe they're starting to, and there's actually try to bring people together, think about some of those kind of things. My experience on talking to people who work on evolutionary algorithms is also a problem of extrapolation, is they tend to do as well as they can with the computers. They show how impressive it is, But they don't go and say, well, you know, how well could I have done with a 10-year-old computer? So you can try to maybe infer what you could do with a 10 years from now computer. There is an exception to that, which is chess playing computers. Chess playing computers, when I was at 79, and Ken Thompson, one of the inventors of Unix, and Joe Condon made a chess playing computer in their spare time on a little PDP-11 with a little bit of extra hardware, and beat all the ones playing on the big supercomputers with huge teams. And they then were the first to get to master level. I'm not sure if they pushed all the way to grandmaster level. But at a stage before they even got to master level, I asked him how long would it take to beat the best person in the world. And I thought, Ken's a cautious guy. I have no idea. But he didn't. He said, well, we know that for every half move depth we go, we increase the by so many points on the chess ranking. Okay? And we know that for every such and such amount of computer speed increase, we can go an extra half move depth and extrapolate. So if we extrapolate that, and then we had gone from sub-novice up to expert level, if we extrapolate that and we assume that the scale is, you know, is roughly proportioned all the way up, then, and this was in 1980, we would expect to be able to beat the best person in the world at about right around the end of the century. He said, well, there's some uncertainty in that. The biggest thing, I think, is whether the scale is more nonlinear at the high end, and so it could be a bit longer. But he was right. Okay. And that was a case of a really complicated thing. By going from really primitive to something level, they were at least able to make a guess as to how to extrapolate. But my experience with evolutionary algorithms is not that much of that has been done. And one of the things one learns from statistical physics is the power of sort of trying to build things up in a way you hope you can extrapolate.
I don't know if this is too significant, but all through this I've been wondering about all the lethal mutations.
Yeah.
In other words, you're measuring non-lethal mutations here.
Well, beneficial ones even, mainly, yeah.
So I'm wondering how you can estimate, like, how many mutations are you missing by all the ones that, I mean, that failed, of which there must have been maybe many more than you observed.
That's right. So most mutations are deleterious in an organism that's well-adapted. Quite a lot of them have almost no effect in that conditions, and some small fraction are beneficial. The scenario I showed with the Procolococcus, the imaginary scenario, it involves two intermediate steps, which were bad. Now, of course, what would happen in practice, they wouldn't all happen at once. It'd be more or less unlikely that one would happen, that organism would struggle to survive, but maybe just survive long enough that it had another mutation happened in it. So the bad ones can be sort of very important in sort of getting you onto a new hill. And they are also reasons for not having the mutation rate too high. Right, so what the clear reason the mutation rate isn't too high is because of deleterious mutations, and this is what causes cancers. Right? We get mutations in your cells when they divide, and you get cancers and things coming from that. And the cancers tend to get higher mutation rate themselves, and that makes it worse. So there's that balance there. A certainly very large numbers of deleterious mutations that play important roles, because if you have a positive one and a small negative one, that can hitchhike along, and then it's there, and you've got a new variant. And that then you're exploring evolutionary roots more, even though you had some things that actually were bad at the time.
Given the fact that Charles Darwin didn't understand the mechanisms of mutations and didn't understand anything about DNA, could you help us understand a few of the things that you presented tonight that would absolutely surprise Mr. Darwin?
I guess you'd have to ask more of the historians than of science and evolution biologists on that. And I think even if he could imagine that there was some chemical source of the information in the organism that was passed down, and he presumably worried a lot about that, the fact that you could actually go in and find it and read the information, I'm sure he would be completely completely blown away by it. I mean, 15 years ago when we'd be blown away by that, of what you can do now. And it's at the stage where you can't even, now I find I can dream of things that people who work much more on the subject can't, because I happen to have one of the great experts on making new ways of doing things, Steve Quake, right around down the corridor. So I think there are a huge number of things that he would find amazing. The rates of evolution, you can get things happen really fast, like a multicellular organism coming quickly. He seemed to generally think things were very slow, with exceptions of when you really strongly drove it, like for domestication of crops and things. But I think I'm the wrong person to try to answer that.
Okay, let's thank Daniel one more time. And just to remind everybody, we have light refreshments out near the courtyard, so you can just go out and towards the courtyard. Thank you.